Hello, this is Scott Wells with The Magic Word, and today my guest is Aaron Fisher. Hey, Aaron, how you doing?
Hi, Scott. I'm great. I mean, we had a good time tonight, so I'm relaxed and here.
Okay, relaxed and chilling now.
Doing it, yeah.
Yeah, so you just finished your lecture here in Houston, and this is like, what, about halfway through the lecture, I guess, roughly now? Or
through the tour, I would say we are better than two-thirds of the way through.
Moving on through.
Yeah,
okay.
No, it's a good thing. It's a good
and
thing.
You're heading from the West Coast to the East Coast. I mean, you've been living in L.A. for, what, 20 years? Seems like.
It started when, do you remember when I met you?
Was that at Fector's?
I met so many people for the first time. I had so many first time experiences, but I would imagine there was a lot of people that were meeting less new people every year than I was. So you probably remember meeting me, but I was too busy basking in the light of Harry Lorraine.
I remember that year.
You know, for the first, oh, sure, we all remember. It was big for me.
You know, I kept a cassette tape. It was kind of cool. That was when he was lecturing, and I was sitting in the front row there at Fector's, and put that cassette tape, you know, on the table as he was lecturing. And I remember it stopped, and then he stopped in the middle of a sentence and waited until I turned the tape over, popped it back in, and then he said, "You know, I'm just waiting for you when you're ready." It's picked up from there.
A real showman.
And of course, he remembered where he was. Mm-hmm. He has that kind of memory, you know.
Sure.
What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, no, so I moved to Las Vegas in 1997, mm-hmm. and lived there for a couple of years. Came back, graduated from school, got my stuff together, moved to L.A., man, did that for 10 years. And just recently put that behind me a couple of years ago and moved up north and, you know, sort of shifted some of my energy a little bit from, you know, doing every show and sort of scrabbling for every single show imaginable. And now I'm doing the ones that I like, and I'm working with 50 students online and just focused on teaching magic one-on-one, sort of the way that we learned it,
right.
You know, back when there were magic stores. And
the brick and mortar back.
Yeah, a whole guild system that was sort of, you know, centered in those stores.
And that's true. You know, I learned a lot from the magic shops. You know, whenever I used to go, it was the guys who would hang out the shops. You know, that would show me stuff. It wasn't at the club meetings. It was the magic shop. It was kind of like an old barber shop, I guess, of old days, or around the Cracker Barrel or whatever, before that in the 1800s or whatever.
So no one was cool enough to have a Playboy, but yes.
Yeah. So you really don't have that anymore, and so you've kind of recreated that with the Skype now? Or?
Well, I sort of feel like, and you know exactly what I'm talking about because I see how much effort you put into your own magical community, both locally and nationally, and now on the net, and I have to commend you for being, you know, of your generation. You don't see a lot of guys who are embracing these opportunities. And the problem is, because the real magicians didn't embrace the internet, it was left to the non-real magicians to embrace it first.
Right, and look what they've done with it.
And look what they did with it. So, you know, the internet gets a bad rap for having destroyed magic when basically it's as good as the information and the people who are using it. And so now that the technology is good enough, you know, I mean, you know, I don't even know if I talked about this in the lecture. Would you ever send your child to learn karate from a videotape? Or tennis from a videotape?
Yeah.
Or anything that is an ancient, old thing that requires a little bit of training.
Although there are people who put out DVDs and tapes and, you know.
And then those things are all wonderful.
Yeah.
But in terms of making sense of it all and teaching a young man how to put it together.
Right.
There's nothing like a little handheld instruction. You know,
there's no question about that. Well, and that's where you come in, I guess, with your Skype lessons. Tell me more about that and how that developed.
Well, I mean, I was teaching lessons, and actually,
came to your house to. Or
no, what? I would meet people. That's the way I met my teachers. You know, I would meet them at a coffee shop or something, or at the magic store, depending on where I was living, and you know how much they liked me at the magic store.
Yeah.
And what really started the shift in my head about it, because I really. You know, I was raised by a few crusty card men, and I was reasonably crusty card man. You know, it wasn't enough to be good. You had to, you know, other folks had to be bad.
And, well, tell me some of your mentors. We're kind of getting off subject, but...
I started to list them in answer to Greg's question. Was it Greg's question?
Yeah, Greg Lancaster, yeah.
You know, my first teacher was Jack Burnman, and he was a great, eccentric, totally original underground card man in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And then I went off to Baltimore and I stumbled into the Denny and Lee Magic Studio. And, you know, I wanted to talk about magic all night long. And Denny allowed that for a little while. But eventually he introduced me to Pete Galinskis, who's a student of the great Baltimore card expert Frank Thompson, who, you know, Steve Freeman once described to me as being Edward Marlowe with nothing in print. You know, that's Frank Thompson.
That's good.
And so that's his student Peter was who taught me really how to read some of Erdnase for myself and really sort of start to put that stuff together for real. But once again, I don't know anybody who really just sprouted from the ground and was able to understand that book, mm-hmm. you know, as Vernon claims to have been able to do.
Well, he had to study it and, you know, it became the Bible of his and would make the notes inside. And
I was trained that it was. And I think mm-hmm. for the purposes of actual mechanics of sleight of hand,
yeah,
I haven't found one more useful. They would approach it, huh? Not more seminal than that. It's sort of the book of natural sleight of hand technique.
It is seminal. I mean, you look at the College of Card College.
Sure.
Yeah, it's good and technical, and but it. Yeah, I guess it's kind of been done. I mean, earlier,
We could talk about that stuff all night, but in terms of the Erdnase thing, I sort of feel like it's the proto. Version. Mm-hmm, it's the book. It's, in the same way they talk about Mesopotamia, Sumeria sort of being the first language that mm-hmm. was the precursor of all language.
Right.
When you start reading that Erdnase material, it sort of teaches you how mechanics work mm-hmm. in a way that nothing else can. You know, it's like studying the root as opposed to the branches.
Yes, right, right, right.
And at least that's what I was taught. And you know, of course, and here's the other thing about it. There's all kinds of wonderful aspects of magic, and there's all kinds of people who are excellent at presentation, and others who are just excel at attention management, and people who are really great writers, and mm-hmm. all these different areas.
Everyone has their own specialty, true.
Sure, but when it comes down to real sleight of hand, card experts of the old order that we might name, Vernon, mm-hmm. and others that we might name, all of them got their grounding there first.
Yeah, but there are so many who we don't know or will never know who were the gamblers
sure.
that Erdnase would write about. You know,
sure.
it took their ideas and things who were the real true mechanics, if you will.
Well, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, I mean, this is where I would get out of my ability to speak particularly confidently about some of this because, you know, no, I mean, just recently I have a friend who's writing a book who I can't even mention his name right now because of the theories that are all these theories are coming out now about what Erdnase's real mm-hmm. nature
now, Richard Hatch,
was.
I know, just recently
but that whole thing,
yep. yes,
there was
exactly.
a whole party up there and
mm-hmm.
everything. Yeah, and so I don't know about all that, so I can't speak about all the current latest and greatest. I just know that for whatever reason, and whatever Erdnase's, I mean, so many times in my life I've met real gamblers who are not nearly as technically proficient as they are filled with all sorts of bombast and abilities to just sort of, they have chutzpah. They have a certain, you know, ability to put the stuff over. And then you actually look at what they're doing with their fingers in some cases.
Yeah.
And it's just nasty looking.
But their bombacity is strong enough to overlook some of their lack of card skill with the card. And don't you think that that's just, has to do with a lot of success for magicians as well? I mean, you could transpose that over there. I mean, some of the best magicians may not be the most technically inclined, you know, guys. You know, they may do some simple stuff. Well, for an example, you know, there have been a lot of guys who have just made a living of doing some great magic. It's been funny, but it's been very easy, technically not proficient.
No, and of course it's no fun to name those guys, but
yeah
obviously. So all we're talking about when we talk about Erdnase is for those who bring it all the way down to that level as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we have to say that if you're a great magician, you don't have to be excellent in any one of those areas, but you certainly have to be proficient in whatever you're doing, or mm-hmm. at least to the point that it supports what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
to the point where it doesn't crash the whole castle. Right? So
yeah.
even these fellows that we might talk about who are famous entertainers, who are yeah. really marvelous magicians, who you would never consider to be technical guys, are clever enough not to do the kind of material that's going to reveal that.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? They know how to pick their material
yes.
in such a way that they are playing to their strengths. And so, you know, they have a sense of what makes their stuff work. And, you know, it's just like anything else. You know your strengths.
That's right.
You know your weaknesses, and you play to your strengths, and, you know, you can stay safe.
Well, I was thinking, you know, like the Foxy one, you know, that
I never got to see Carol Fox.
You never saw Carol Fox?
No, I mean, I love those books.
Awesome. And his book, and that's my point, is that his type of books were those, I think, that were quite easy to do that anybody could do and thought, well, that's within my grasp, and he could sell a ton of them if he wanted to, of people who just, you know, wanted to learn some easy magic. And certainly it was easy magic, but it all came down to presentation, which he was doing, and he had such great presentation and,
charm.
Bombacity. That goes back to what I'm saying. You see, that I believe that he had good skills and he had the chops to do whatever kind of classic passes or whatever, but that's not what he taught. That's not what he did. And he always felt like that if there is an easy way to do it, then why not? You know, why do you have to do the knuckle busting then necessarily?
Well, I think that gets back to the fact that he was really, in some ways, a real specialist in the effect itself. Mm-hmm. And there's so many, like I say, so many of our sleight of hand artists excel in things like construction or structure or the place where sleights and misdirection meet structure. They always tend to drive the train with the thing that makes them very, very special. But then you have these guys, these sort of burglars, you know, mm-hmm. comes to mind, and you know, they go straight for the effect.
Yeah.
And I sort of put Carol Fox, I mean, from just reading those books, and it's not fair because I never really got to see him, but I sort of always put him in that class of a performer that really just understood how audiences appreciate magic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Directly. And so he could skip a lot of that stuff in the middle that fascinates a lot of us mm-hmm. in terms mm-hmm. of what we spend our time on in many cases and get right to the perceived effect from the direction of the audience. And that's why he was allowed to, that's why he was able to just cut all of that stuff out of those methods.
But you see also then some of the guys who are the professional, early trade show workers who were very successful and also technically proficient.
Like Eddie Tully.
I was about to say, Eddie would just do a top change,
sure.
you know, and would command a huge audience, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't get to talk about it in the lecture tonight, but that's when I'm working with people, it normally comes out that magicians are all afraid of the top change because mm-hmm. they perceive it to be something that's not invisible, and they want it, something that's invisible. They're scared of stuff that isn't.
Sure.
But
or palming a card or something.
Well,
yeah.
Certainly. But,
copping them.
But specifically on the whole switching thing, that double turnover mm-hmm. has so many different pieces to it. There's so many things you have to do to put over a double turnover.
Yeah.
Once you actually figure all that out, you learn the top change is just, hey, hold out your hand. Bam, it's over. It's one move. You don't even need a break.
Yeah.
It's over in a heartbeat, and once you actually become enough of a misdirective guy to really work a double turnover beautifully, you'd much prefer a top change.
Yeah.
Because it's over already, and you're back onto the show.
That's right.
You know? But as long as you're still thinking people are staring at you,
mm-hmm.
you're making them stare at you. And as long as you're making them stare at you, you'll never be able to get through. Let me ask you this question. Was there a point in your coming up when something like the top change terrified you?
Yeah, because I was afraid they were going to be watching me, you mm-hmm. know, until I had, you know, heard the advice, you know, don't run if no one's chasing you, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a thing, because I was afraid that everyone was, you know, burning my hands. So then I stopped watching my hands, and I started watching their eyes, and I learned a long time ago that the audience is going to look where you look, mm-hmm. but there are some, of course, whose attention won't be diverted. You just change the moment. As Roger Clouse had taught me, if you can't change a method, change the moment, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's, yeah, something that I had to become comfortable with, finding the right moment to do a top change. And there are some a couple of tricks in my repertoire where I would use a bluff pass mm-hmm. and a top change that are part of my standard show that I'll do 20 or more times a night, you know, in a strolling, you know, type of situation. I mean, and another one is a side steal, you know, that you just have to feel comfortable, you know, in doing it.
You have to know how to work in the shadow.
Yes.
Which is weird, because when you've first several thousand hours in magic, there's a spotlight on you. It really seems like there is no shadow.
That's exactly right. But I think it's through performance that you will start to get more comfortable in your skin, if you will. And that's not something that you can learn by just watching YouTube, you know, and practicing in front of a mirror. Two things you can't practice are timing and misdirection. Mm-hmm. You have to have an audience to do that. And I think that by sitting at home or watching YouTube, you're not going to be, or DVDs of somebody, that you're not, you know, getting the kind of personal instruction. You're not, you know, getting that feedback, mm-hmm. you know. That's why it's important, I think, to attend conventions, to see other people, to see their styles.
See magicians.
And talk to them, you know, and session and hang out at night and have discussions like we're having now, you know, that are the real meat and potatoes, I think, of what makes a magician magical. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it that makes people go, or what, you know, that moment of awe or whatever, you know, that it is, certainly. But I think that you know, I've always said that a picture's worth 1,000 words, you know, and then a video is worth 1,000 pictures, mm-hmm. you know. But on a one-on-one situation, that's like, well, do it again, or let me see it from a different angle or whatever, you know.
And without that component, it's even worse. The YouTube and the video actually becomes your frame of reference. And so you start thinking that what you're seeing is what you're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you well know, when you're shooting something for the screen,
right,
that's a variation. That's a different, you know, it's like you and I know that there's a difference between performing for three people, 5 people, 10 people, 20 people. One camera with 2 people is a completely unique thing designed to make it look like you're performing for them, but yeah. really being performing for the camera.
That's right.
And when you watch and you learn, and that counts in the same way that just taking an illustration for a magic book isn't quite like it really your hands would be, mm-hmm. because the camera's got to be in there. And plus, it's not in real life. You wouldn't
camera's
be able to
not
see
there.
It.
That's right.
And you wouldn't be able to see it. So mm-hmm. it's not only mm-hmm. for the camera, it's so that it's exposed.
Right.
So it's not quite like it is in real life. And sort of as you learn how to read magic books, you sort of learn how to make those allowances and realize when the person who shot this, their elbow was up and that's where the camera was. That kind of thing.
Yeah, but if you're watching the video, you might think, I'm supposed to have my elbow up.
Completely.
Yeah.
And you have to learn that way. And so I think what ends up happening is when you're watching YouTube, well, no, I mean, it breaks your whole mind. You mm-hmm. know, the whole thing is being photographed that
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you start thinking magic is something you watch as opposed to something that you're in
interacting.
The same space
yes.
with
yeah.
the magician and the people. And it's a whole 3, 4, 5D thing that never happens in a video.
Well, in all fairness also, I think a lot of people who are watching YouTube and learning from that medium are enjoying it for their own masturbation, you know, purposes. They're just, you know, having cards in their hand and they like doing it self-gratification, basically. It's not...
Self-gratification sounds so much nicer than masturbation, but it doesn't feel as good.
So if you're going out actually and you need to share, you know, your magic with other people...
Your seed, if you will.
Yeah. So, well, keeping that same analogy going, I guess.
Sorry.
But the point is, I don't think there's anything wrong necessarily for somebody learning it if they're only doing it for themselves because they really enjoy that. I've had a lot of friends who only perform for themselves and who are technically proficient, but you know, really couldn't entertain outside of the garage.
I got
you know?
A theory about that. I know what you mean, and you're right. It's all cool, and you're sure they couldn't, and they will profess to you till their dying day that they have no interest in it. They simply love doing what they're doing, and that's fine, but that's what they've told themselves because they got to a place where they were scared.
Yeah.
And we all come to that place, and some of us deal with it differently than others, and some of us fight through it for 20 years, and some of us never get over it, and some of us become full-time magicians and drink ourselves to death because they never get over it.
Yeah.
But they found that little loophole, you know?
Yeah.
Right? And I just feel like, and because I see this with my students all the time, I just believe that when a person gets into magic, and I could be wrong in some cases, but I don't think it's half as often as we'd like to believe, we're terrified, we love what's happening, we just want to be a part of it so much. But I think if they weren't so scared of the idea of putting themselves on the line and accepting what's going to come from that.
That's a good point.
Of course they want to do magic. It's just that the water gets pretty deep pretty
yeah.
fast. And there's nothing worse than getting busted doing a magic trick. You know
That's
what
right.
I mean?
Oh,
it's embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's scandalous.
I was working with a guy as a student once who was using a thumb tip, dropped it in the middle of the show, and he said, oh, guess you know how that was done. He picked it up and he stopped. I mean, he had a whole routine he was going to do for like 20 minutes, and this happened like 5 minutes into it. And he just was freaked out, and he said, I don't think I'll ever do another trick. I mean, it just, he was so petrified after.
Scandalized.
Yeah.
A friend of mine loved playing guitar, but never wanted to play it in front of people, and I believe it was a similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course he wanted to play it in front of people. He wanted people to hear the music that he loved so much. That's why
sure.
he got into it. He saw people sharing it.
And enjoying it. Sure.
And what anyone thinks is more or less something like this. Wow. Wouldn't making people feel the way I feel right now be the most fun ever?
Yeah.
And then, of course, you practice a million years, and then you begin to discover, oh, there's something in between me and that thing that I was dreaming about that I never thought about. It's the actual standing naked in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And that friend of mine recently started to play the guitar in front of people in very guarded situations. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, I learned something very, very important about playing a song the other day. And I said, well, what's that?
Yeah.
And he said, well, when you mess up, you just keep going.
Yeah, because they don't know.
And I just went, you know, and I thought about when I'd first discovered that in Magic
yeah.
20 years ago. And I went, mm-hmm. yeah, man, truer words were never spoke.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there will be tons of embarrassing moments.
That is the whole point. And that's why that I think the deeper your knowledge in magic, the more able you are equipped in order to handle situations when you play the wrong note. Because you can disguise that with the rest of the beat or whatever else is happening. And the same thing like with music. If somebody selects the wrong card, you do a different trick. They don't know what the outcome is going to be.
My favorite bands, for example, are six guys each improvising full speed for hours on end. The number of mistakes, to say that those number of mistakes that they make in an evening are in the hundreds, has got to be an understatement.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing is, you know, how you put it together. I was talking to a friend of mine who's an expert in painting the other day, and apparently, you know, these things are canvases. They're not happening with pencils. It never ends up being what you wanted it to be. It's how you wrestle it back down from oblivion when it's all getting away from you.
Yeah.
You know? You know? And how many times tonight did I feel like I had just missed entirely? You know, and especially as you're getting to know an audience.
Sure.
You're in a different part of the world. It's not your core group.
There's no question about that. When you're performing, I mean, you have certain lines and presentation for a particular trick, and you're going through this routine in your mind, and you know what works and doesn't work, but there may be some situation which you're scrambling because a joke doesn't work or that... Whatever it is, you know, and you're going to have...
A thousand things.
That's right.
Technical things.
Death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah. Death by a thousand cuts, which I guess that sounds like a Buck Twins video.
I guess it would be, yeah, for someone who is practicing some of their stuff. Well, I kind of went all the way around the barn on that one. To come back, you were talking about your...
This is a freewheeling opportunity.
It is. To talking about those who were your mentors earlier on in life and that had led you then. You were talking about the Skype type of lessons that you're giving now. You say about have about 50 students. So you can live literally anywhere in the world and be teaching to people in Bolivia or wherever.
I have students on a lot of continents. I won't say all of them, but just about all of them.
That's pretty cool. You know?
And it's really great because I remember when I wanted to start learning magic, you know, I felt like I couldn't learn any magic where I was. And I changed my schooling. I went from, you know, Baltimore, Maryland to go forward. I transferred to Las Vegas so that I could start hanging out with Michael Skinner, so that I could meet the great Tom Stoney, so that I could start to see...
Now, did magic move you? I mean, that was the reason you had left?
Yes. Yeah, I went to visit a friend out there. I had dinner with Mike Skinner. I went out to L.A. I saw the Magic Castle for the first time, and I went, all right.
This is where I want to...
Later, kids, yeah. I'm going to go work this thing out. I told my parents, mm-hmm. I'm transferring school. First of all, you tried telling this to me. Hey, I'm taking a semester off.
Yeah.
Well, they're not
flying.
Well, it didn't fly at all. And then I went out to Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. You know, my buddy Lee Asher was going to school out there. And
we LBM. Started
to, yeah. Yeah, no, mm-hmm. we were at UNLV. And, you know, every day was magic. It was Saturdays with Mike Skinner and, you know, Bob Kohler and Earl Nelson. And the guys were in town for the Magical Empire all the time.
Oh, yeah, back in those days.
I knew it one night. I was hanging out with Jeff McBride at 2 a.m. in the morning at someone's house. That was never going to happen where I lived. You know, all of a sudden mm-hmm. I was just at a party.
Yeah.
And here's Jeff McBride. Hey, what do you do? Hey, you're Jeff McBride.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was nervous. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, I was excited. This was like a whole, you know, I was at the Shamada house hanging out with Jeff McBride. I'm in college.
Yeah.
I shouldn't even be here, you know.
But you kind of got on the inside.
Well, all of a sudden I realized this thing about that is just show up. It's like old Woody Allen said, half a life is just showing up.
Yeah.
But that's sort of what happened.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people who get pretty far just showing up.
Mm-hmm.
And before I knew it, you know, I realized that, I mean, I had a lot of great experiences, but one of the greatest experiences I had was realizing that Las Vegas was no place for me.
Yeah. That was not where you wanted to live?
Well, yeah.
This wasn't your scene, huh?
Well, the only things that grow there are cacti.
Yeah, and fake boobs.
There it is. And so I went home, and then I moved out to L.A. and started to, you know, slowly, bit by bit, I was got dragged into this dawning realization that no matter what I thought, I was a magician.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no other road for me. And for me, it was primarily about the fact that I was terrified, and I didn't think I could do it, and I just couldn't stand living my life anymore, thinking that I was afraid to do the thing I wanted to do.
So you really had a passion for it.
What could I do?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't... I tried to do other things.
But you could... Could you see a financial gain where that you could be successful? I mean, at what point did you say, I can do this?
You mean as a living?
Yes.
A few years later, things started to shift. But, you know, it was... That first thing is faith, man.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are so many young people who, I'm sure, who have asked you, as they have me, to say, you know, I would like to go do magic full time. You know, I said, well, get your college education first.
I say, hey, man.
Yeah.
Watch out. Watch out. You know, the advice that they gave me in school I still think is pretty wise. They said, hey, if there's anything you can do in the entire world besides this, do it. You're going to make sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be times when you doubt your very existence. It's not pretty.
Yeah.
If you can find another way to make a living that you can be happy doing, select that way.
Yeah.
And I still think that's pretty wise, because at the end of the day, it's like Joseph Campbell in The Hero, was a journey in The Call to Adventure. You know, it's a big mine shaft, and it should say, danger, keep out, keep out, keep out, keep out. And the only people that should really be in there are the ones that looked at that and had to go in anyway.
Hmm.
You know, it takes courage.
Yeah.
And because you're going to face a few bears in there.
When the sign says abandon all hope and you just press on.
If you're that type.
Yeah.
This could be the league of career for you. Yeah, but at the end of the day, it's not what anyone thinks it is. And it won't be. And let's say one other thing about that is, I know as many different paths to success in professional magic as I know professional magicians. There are no two people who are really doing it that are doing it alike. You will find your own path, and it won't be the same as Scott's, and it won't be the same as mine.
Right. Although a lot of people tend to be clones, they try to be. You remember after Lance Burton, everybody wanted to, their act looked like his, or it looked like Copperfield's or whomever. They thought those are the successes, or it's David Blaine or Chris Angel.
Well, notice I didn't say no two acts are the same.
Yeah.
I said no two paths to success. You know, the mix, the kinds of work you do. I mean, we've been talking tonight about 1,000 different kinds of acts that you can do, you personally, and 1,000 different ways that you can work for your clients.
Yeah.
And I know most people I know can't do a half of the things that you can do to make it work, to make it all come together.
Mm-hmm.
So that versatility is part of what makes you,
you.
Special in your case. And in any case, and I've got some versatility, but it's not the same. It's different
than yours. Right.
We've got some things in common and other things not in common.
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, I just know that I was out there probably working for about 5-6 years. And in the midst of the whole Magic Castle thing, which is a lot like the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, there's a lot of too many magicians in 1 5-foot radius, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you look at the nature of the magical figure in the world, I mean, you know, you need a lot more lawyers to run a village than you need magicians.
Hmm.
You need a certain, you know, per 100,000 people.
Yeah.
You know, you need a certain number of doctors, certain number of lawyers, certain number of school teachers, certain number of police officers, and one magician.
Well, it's because those are required things, whereas magic is something for people with discretionary income. You know.
Well, no, I mean, I think I'm just talking about anthropologically.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You need a wizard.
Yeah.
You just don't need as many.
Yeah, there's only one witch doctor in a village.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You need one shaman. One shaman. And so I think, you know, when you get them all together, it's weird. You know, all of a sudden you got, you know, a lot of magicians in one spot. And so around that time, which was great for me because I got to learn so much and I really developed an act and worked the act and became, I think, a professional in the important ways that you must. I mean... And this is something that a friend of mine who's a very excellent stand-up comedian said. The hard part about the internet era is it's becoming, what's happened to entertainment for the public is it's become much, much harder to find a place to even make your bones that way. It's much, much harder now to find a place to be bad.
That's a fact.
Than it was 10 years ago.
Even. Yeah, yeah.
You know. So in any event, I was very happy to do all that. And then around that time, probably about 10 years ago, I went up to the Sorcerer's Safari Summer Camp for the first time in Toronto.
As a teacher?
Yeah, as a special guest that year. And it was run by Magic Mike and Jen Siegel there in Toronto, in the woods near there. And I got to start teaching magic there as a special guest. I was terrified of these kids.
Because you felt like...
I was one. No.
I was going to say they were not too far removed from you age-wise, and they might be smarter in certain areas or felt threatened. Or?
I didn't feel like they were smarter. I just felt like, you know, this is going to be one long bar mitzvah. And I don't like working bar mitzvahs. Okay. You know, it was more like that. It's like, I remember a dear friend of mine who's a counselor there, I hopped on the bus my very first minute, and I was nervous and saying things that I didn't even mean. And she said, well, are you excited about camp? And I was like, I hate kids. And there were these kids all over this bus, and they were dangling from the rafters. I'm going to die. Yeah. And they're like, wait till you see. And so then, you know, I started teaching these kids, and I started to realize that I had a lot of really good teachers, but they also taught in pretty old school magic ways. They taught the way they were taught, you know, by their teachers. And some of the ways we were taught was, you know, to call it tough love is to put it mildly. But I think part of that has to do with the fact that magic was a world of secrets. And it still is, but in a different
way. And an apprenticeship also.
Yeah, a real guild system.
Exactly, a real guild system.
And that's the part that's kind of seems to have, we've lost a generation Eroded. So far.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Do you think we'll get that back?
Well, we got to see how this whole internet scheme of ours goes.
Can go in any direction, that's true.
Well, I got a bunch of students. It has yet to be seen what happens to them over time, you know what I mean?
And do they sign a contract? I mean, do they on for a while, or they can come and go
no,
as they
I mean,
want?
Most of them buy 5 lessons at a clip because you get a better price that way.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, I would say the vast majority of them continue because they see...
the value.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, if you're buying magic DVDs every week and then you're wondering why you're never getting any better at it, you know, it doesn't take very long. I mean, look, when I started working with Jack Berman, I started getting better at magic instantaneously.
Yeah.
You know, and like week after week, and that's the whole point about it.
But you had a passion to continue to pick up on the lessons and follow what he was directing and read the books that
suggest. Well, nothing like getting better to make you feel like practice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And when you were getting better, were you showing friends, or how did you develop? You know what I'm saying? Is he would teach you something, and did you go home and practice this, or did you then go and find your friends, hey, look at this, or pick a card? Or,
all of that. All of that. I mean, I was pretty much 24/7, I got to be honest. I mean, a lot of my what's nice about all the effort I'm putting into this process is that I have a lot of students that don't have a ludicrous amount of time to practice. They're grown people. They have lives. They have wives.
So these are just not kids. These are adults or grown adults with professions, other professions.
Yeah, most of them. I mean, most of my kids meet with me less often because...
they don't have the cash.
They don't have the cash, right? And so I got a lot of students that meet with me once a week. I got most meet with me once every 2 weeks. A lot of the younger fellows meet with me once a month, once every 6 weeks. And, of course... they're very, very passionate. Then they're saving up to do this. And so what we just concentrate on doing is really getting right down to business. Because they got a lot of stuff to work on. I need to see where everything is, where it's at. And then I start laying down
what their level of competence is and all that.
Well, things here's the thing. When you are dedicated and you are studying magic relentlessly.
Yeah.
And you're going to do it with help and you're going to do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
You do not care because you are born to be in magic. Right? As the penguin says, born to perform. You're ready to do it.
Yeah.
It's like trying to watch a rapidly growing plant or something. It's trying to like just keep it trimmed, you know, some topiary with some crazy growth hormones in it. I'm just trying to get in there and keep them straight because they are all over the place.
Good point.
And I know that if I can just give them enough direction
and focus.
Keep them busy. You see, here's the thing. God help you if you don't give a student enough to work on. And he's rabid. Because what he's going to do is he's going to just pick up the first video that runs across his screen or something. He's going to just pick up and he's going to go.
And follow that.
Well, he just needs something to eat. And if you don't feed him nutritious food, he's just going to eat what's on the counter. And so you need to make sure he's got enough stuff to work on. That if he gets bored practicing the thing he's got to work on. Look, I don't know about you, but I never practice one thing at a time.
Hey, kind of run in different directions and everything. So do you have like a planned program or something that you're supposed to follow this? I mean, or do you give them a syllabus of or direction, you know, a
most
workshop or workshop?
Every student is completely different. I have a generalized curriculum, but here's the thing. Hardly ever do the rabid ones come in at the beginning. Now, oftentimes they should, but they always come in with 1,000 things that they're working on already and 1,000 pieces of material that are likely not working in a wide variety of situations, but often they're completely misdiagnosing their problem. So they'll come in and say something like, I'm just having trouble putting it all together. Well, no, you're having trouble here, 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 and here, and that's why it's not coming together. Now what we have to do with those students is help them start to see what's going on, because it's not just enough. You can't just start and come in and say, hey, your double S's are wrong, let's teach it to you. Well, that's true in most cases, but they don't understand why. So all you're doing is trying to change what it is they're doing, but they haven't, you know, they got any real reason to buy into that yet. You know what I mean? They don't know. It doesn't make, it's got to make sense.
They can't see that it makes sense to them,
So you really, the hard part is, while I have a curriculum and I have a series of techniques and every kind of category that are designed to work with them and help them put it all together, and most importantly, be compatible with each other, you know, so that all the words you're speaking come in from the same language. So every brick fits up against a brick. You turn around in 6-8 months, you start to look like you have a house, you know, as opposed to just a collection of what we joke around from my friend who had guitar lessons, tasty licks. You know, because anyone can give you magic lessons and teach you tasty licks. Hey, here's a move. Wow, far out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you're a directionless student who's just trying to learn everything he can, that's going to seem great.
Well, isn't that kind of like what C.S. Lewis had said, you know, in Alice in Wonderland, if you don't know where you're going in any direction's fine. You know, you just need to know, keep focused on some direction where you want to go. You have to have an end game in mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're goal oriented, right? And and those kids or those students, I should say, in many cases, it's a very interesting process getting in and helping them start to see what's making it work, and in many cases, making it not work.
Right.
And then eventually, through this process, because we normally start with working on some of the routines that they have. Now, oddly enough, my students who grow the fastest are the ones who come in and say, here's what I'm doing. Where do you think I should start? And I go, I think we should start at the beginning. And they go, great.
Yeah.
And I go, great. Yeah. And we start at the beginning, and all of a sudden it's like, whoosh, everything's beautiful. And very short period of time, a couple months, things are just flying.
That makes sense.
But when you have students who have a great many preconceived notions.
Right.
And they, you know, they're where I was. They're banging their head against a brick wall and wondering why
they're not getting any better.
Their forehead's wet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you start to go, well, listen, bro, maybe we ought to reconsider this thing here. And they go, no, I love this double lift. And you're like, but it's
not really working.
Going to help you, man.
Yeah.
And so it's getting to the point where the longer we go on, we're starting to pre-qualify the students somewhat, because at the end of the day, you know, student needs to know what he's in for. And
right.
That's what I try and tell them. I say, hey, look, I can teach you magic, but if you and I both don't agree on what it is you need to be learning.
Yeah, we're not doing either of ourselves any favor.
I just want to make you really happy, and I don't want to make you promises I can't keep.
Right.
So I'm happy to give you lessons, but are you willing to reconsider how you're doing everything?
Let me go in a little different direction that has to do with creativity. That since you are a creative card inventor of sorts, and and your book on the paper engine that has sold so well in thousands of copies having been sold over the last decade.
Yeah, well, you know, I was very fortunate.
Did you come up with things automatically? I think the answer is no. That they have come hard. I don't think your ideas have just come as an inspiration where you wake up in the middle of the night and say, I better write that down.
Some have, but how those things go is like the old story about the apple falling from the tree, you know what I mean?
It has to hit you in the head?
No. No, it's like it falls in one moment, but it's been dangling off that branch and gravity's been working on it for a good long while, and then all of a sudden it falls.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like panic came to me all at once after I'd been working on how to do left-handed bluff grips for like 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I had it in one moment.
Yeah.
But not really.
I hear so many magicians who have lectured, including Roger Klaus and others, I remember saying that well, you know, they would show something. It was a minor move. It was like a half move. In fact, Roger called him a half move. And then he'd say, well, there's 10 years of my life. And then he would show something else, and he said, there's another 12. You know, I mean, they were small things.
And I was talking that way during the lecture tonight, too. I've found that same experience. Mm-hmm. You miss Roger?
I do. Sure do. Yeah. In a lot of ways. Yeah. He was such a great guy and profound.
Really taught you a lot about natural sleight of hand.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And some of the best moments were not necessarily just sitting and doing tricks, but just talking. You know, I mean, till the wee hours in the morning, till the sun came up, or, you know, having coffee at Denny's or something, you know, or at a convention, or at the Magic Island having breakfast at 3 in the morning, you know, after it closed or whatever. I mean, yeah, just, we miss him. You know, he and Frank Price, you know, were best friends, and Roger always, you know, stayed over his place.
It was crazy to see Frank tonight. It was such a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, and Gary Plants, too, like you said. Yeah,
that was just a complete shock, you know.
Yeah, kind of talk about an underground guy, you know, see him coming above ground very often.
I see old Gary Plants there. It reminds me of being 18, showing up at Vectors for the first time, being all skeered.
So just quickly, again, on creativity, if I say quickly, that any advice for others who might be coming up with their ideas, or when they present things to you, say, hey, what do you think? Is this new?
You know what? I mean, I have to say, it's always so typical, right, because you say, this is what I think, and then mm-hmm. the person says, well, I see what you did. And you go, yeah, but I didn't know better. I was your age.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You know, I'm sorry. If I had to do it over again, I would have been different. And
sure.
That's how I am now. And so you can't be 30 before you're 20, right? And you can't be 40 before you're 30.
Yeah, you can't drive a car before you ride a tricycle.
You just can't.
Yeah.
And so I believe that so much energy is invested and so much emphasis is placed on novelty. Newness. Hmm. We spoke to a young fellow tonight who was so excited to have a new idea.
Yes.
That, you know, first of all, it's the idea of, you know, the extent to which any of these ideas are particularly new is highly debatable. But also, I feel like we would do a lot better and get a lot more lasting contributions to magic. And meaningful ones to those who are students of the art.
Mm-hmm.
If instead of focusing on coming up with something new and different, as though anything different is good,
yeah,
which, you know, might be that way in some parts of Texas, right? but I was driving through the West there. It was anything different would have been good.
Yes,
but
yeah, because it's all the same for miles and miles.
It was crazy, crazy heavy duty. But I think magic creativity goes much more beautifully when we focus on learning good, well-made magic, good design, good structure, good technique, good misdirection, good presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing fancy, just how to present the effect clearly and make it strong and entertain the audience and make it go over. And in that process, you will encounter an infinite number of problems, real problems, mm-hmm. barriers to doing that. Barriers to getting this card where it's supposed to be then, and how to cover this moment when you need to switch this card or need to reverse that card or, you know, need to get this card in your pocket.
Right, right, right.
And when you start to find methods and answers to those questions that don't break the natural flow of presenting that effect.
Mm-hmm. Or call attention to the... Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many times the thing that you need doesn't exactly exist already. Something close exists.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Hmm.
But the exact thing
that you need,
if you wanted to make it perfect,
yeah.
If you wanted to make it what's in your mind, not what you could copy and plug in from the video,
mm-hmm.
doesn't necessarily always exist in exactly the form you want it. And I always found that when I started to make that sort of connection, that's where the aspect of what I'm doing that you might call creativity, in that way,
mm-hmm.
with the cards. Comes
gotcha.
From.
Okay.
You know? And I invented my share of, hey, look, this is different and new moves. But the ones that I like, the ones that have some staying power, the ones that have some resonance,
mm-hmm.
are the ones that actually solve problems.
Problems, yes.
Yeah. So the first part is learning to recognize problems. So if you're out there going, this is different, well, what problem does it solve?
It was interesting when you were talking about the pop-up move this evening, for example, and you were showing that you were so excited, took that to the World Magic Summit and showing Bob Sheets and everybody, and they said, yeah, but what's the effect? And you had to come back and actually create a trick using that. So it was kind of...
I had to go home and figure out what the hell they meant.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the point.
Yes, yeah.
Right. Learn what an effect is, and you'll have an endless font of creativity.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something Frank Price says to people at meetings all the time, and he'll say, what's the effect? You know? And you really got to study.
I think it's really nice. You know, I've been doing a lot of these magic lectures lately. And it was really nice to be in a little club room where I could spot five magicians who'd been doing magic 30 plus years and five magicians who'd been doing magic 30 plus minutes.
Yeah.
And to watch those, you know, young magicians, some more healed than others, some more polite than others, some more, you know, finished than others.
Yeah.
In all, on all kinds of
levels.
Sure, levels.
Sure.
On every kind of, in every kind of dimension you might think about, and just to see you all coexisting and doing what magicians have been doing
for
hundreds of years, just seeing you guys being patient and, you know, letting the kids hang out, knowing it'll all sort itself out, made me very, very, made me very happy to see
you. Well, good. We try not to be political here, you know, either as far as, you know, having too much politics involved in the clubs, and that's part of the problem with many of the clubs. It seems like that there's this faction that follows this magic shop, and so I'm not going to go and attend the meeting because I'm this guy's buddy, or I'm not going to sit on this side of the room. Ours is a different community, I think, in Houston. We do have a good camaraderie here, you know, and sharing, regardless of whether you're Danny Garcia or some Joe Blow or just shows up. I mean, everybody really shares with each other.
You know, a friend of mine has got a big job somewhere in a government. He's got a big stone block on his desk that says the main thing is that the main thing stays the main thing. And that's sort of how magic needs to be.
Good point.
You know, when you go to a magic club and there's more time moving and seconding than there is doing magic.
Yeah, something's wrong with that.
Voting on the banquet, China.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Who's going to pull the curtains, you know, or whatever. Right. Well, as we wrap up, the name of this podcast is called The Magic Word. So my question to you is, what is your magic word? What's Aaron Fischer's magic word? It's not something necessarily that you would use, you know, in context.
In my mind?
In your mind, your lifestyle, and your mantra, you know, what might be your magic word?
Love.
That's a very good one. I like that. So we'll close on that note. Aaron, thank you again very much. I appreciate you being a guest here on The Magic Word, and I wish you luck on the rest of the tour, and thank you for all of the wisdom you've imparted to us, and I hope everyone else enjoys this as well.
I guess we should have another cocktail.
I kind of like that idea. That's enough for now. Aaron Fischer, and this is me, Scotty out. Better watch your speed. Trouble ahead.